Why the quantum? What is that all about? How do we make sense of the occurrence of quantum phenomena? And there are a number of things that that's going to go along with. Yeah, what actually does it mean, a quantum phenomena? What is something about some observed phenomena that makes it quantum? What kind of physical process can possibly account for such properties? How can we actually think about the occurrence of such properties in a way that makes sense? And often, because quantum phenomena, by the very fact of when you say, well, what makes a phenomena quantum, it's one of the things is it's got to not be classical. But on the other hand, the world we see around us is pretty damn classical. So how does that happen? And also, could it be different? We're not just restricted to saying, you know, let's just try and interpret the quantum formalism. We're going to actually ask the questions, can we go beyond that? Can we find possible generalizations? How will we know that that wasn't the case? And most essentially, we don't do this in a hand-waving way where we just fling around words. We have to be clear, and we have to be precise, and we have to be conceptual. That's why we often talk to philosophers a lot, because they're very good at that. And they make sure we actually keep clear and precise. Well, thinking about quantum phenomena, I'll just sort of start by actually running through, going back to the beginning. Quantum phenomena, we started off by understanding this from interferometry. And we have the standard kind of situation where we have some source. It could be electrons, it could be photons. What's clear, however, is that objects seem to come out from this source one at a time. And it's low intensity, so that at any one time, there's only one of these objects. And it comes out of the source, and we have a screen with two slits in it. And it eventually reaches another screen, and we find that it has this interesting pattern as how it arrives at the screen. It has this intensity that varies along the screen. And interestingly, there are some points where actually that intensity goes to zero. There are points it cannot go. And we notice that it arrives one at a time at the screen, and we get one click. And when we count up all those clicks, we find this intensity things. But we never find a click at that point. But if we go back and we ask how this can be, well, if it had gone out and we happen to block up one of those slits and it arrives at the screen, we get this kind of pattern. And it's got some possibility of arriving at that point. And similarly, if it had gone out and we blocked up the other path, well, we would have a slightly shifted pattern, but still some possibility of arriving at that point. And of course, we have a nice quantum formalism that describes this. That's the down-ket vector. There's the up-ket vector. And there's the superposition of the up and the down that we get when both of them are open. And the superposition says, well, it can't arrive there. Even though each of the individual vectors would say, well, yes, it can. The superposition is not just a statistical ensemble. It's not half the time it's up and half the time it's down. Things happen that are not allowed from just a statistical mixture. We can get this further. We study this one further because this is one of the hearts of the phenomena. You can add a phase shifter. So we add an extra phase to each of the up or down superpositions. And we can make that different. But what happens is that shifts the interference pattern. The amount it shifts depends on the difference between these two phases. Well, that means, again, we can't talk about the idea that this atom has gone down one path somehow, because it has to know to avoid that point now and not that point. And to know to avoid that point, it has to know what the phase setting was in both of the upwind branches. And the consideration of this led to this kind of early worry in quantum theory. What's going on? And an attempt to sort of abandon these kind of pictures of photons following paths or electrons following paths. And Bohr described it as, in any attempt of a pictorial representation of the behavior of the photon, we would thus meet with the difficulty to be obliged to say, on the one hand, the photon always chooses one of the two ways. If we try and look for it, we find it's in one place or the other, and it's never in both. But on the other hand, it behaves as if it's passed both ways. It knows it's got to avoid this point, but that means it's got to know something about both paths. Well, the next thing people say is, well, let's try and find out where it goes. And Heisenberg provided this classic analysis saying, we shine a light. And Feynman elaborated on this point very much in his lectures. What happens though is when you shine the light on it to see what happens, well, it interacts, and that affects the momentum of the particle, and that makes the trajectory go kind of blurry, adds an extra uncertainty, and that smears out the interference. So the suggestion, well, here we go, it's all about the complementarity, it's about this position, momentum, and certainty, right? You're trying to measure which position it is here, but you can't do that without affecting its momentum, and that wipes out the interference pattern. And to some, that was the answer. But we're going for clarity, and we're going for precision. We want to say, how good is that? So a while ago, some people in quantum optics said, is that right? They came up with an optical quantum electrodynamic cavity. What this is a very small device that's tuned to a very particular frequency. And what that means is, if you take an atom, and the atom's in the first excited state, and you tune this cavity to the frequency that corresponds to that excitation between the ground state and the first excited state, and you send that atom through the cavity, the atom emerges in the ground state and a photon's been deposited in the cavity with pretty good certainty, pretty close to one probability. And that doesn't affect the momentum of the atom, negligible change. So what happens if we put those photons, those cavities in the way? Well, here we've got our up and down positions and the atom being in the excited state. You have to be very careful of what kind of atom you use here, though. And originally, no photons in the cavities. Well, it evolves fairly straightforwardly into this entangled state. And what happens? Do we get interference? We haven't changed the momentum. There's been no momentum kick. But we don't get interference. But what you notice is, well, you can look afterwards. Do you see the photon in here, or do you see the photon in there? And if we look, we find either find a photon in there, in which case we get this pattern, or we find a photon in there, in which case we get this pattern. So these are the researchers who said this, said, well, actually, no, it's information. It's because we have information about which path. That's what destroys the interference. There's a wave-particle duality, was the claim from this, but it's actually about information. If we measure which path, and get information about the path. It doesn't matter about momentum, it's just the information about which path that forces it to be a particle. If we don't have that information, it can behave like a wave. Yes?
Sorry, whatever. Okay. How could information possibly affect something that physically happens?
That's a good question. And that's what people who are proponents of that point of view really need to explain. Here's the question, to reformulate it. I don't have a good answer for it. If it's talking about information about which path, then the question you can ask, usually when we mean information about something. We say we have information about which path. We take that to mean there is a matter of fact about what path they took, but we are ourselves not completely certain as to what it is. So we have some measure of information about it, some level of certainty. Whereas here, we have a problem because if we don't have information about which path, well, normally you'd say it took a path, but we don't know which path it took. But here it requires it to actually, if we don't have information about which path, it doesn't take a path at all. But that's not what we normally meant about information. So you change the use of information here. And you have to be, if you want to take that point of view, you've then got to follow through on that with clarity and precision and say just exactly what do you mean by information if you want to change the use of the word. There's other points. When do you actually get the information about which path it took? Because here's a suggestion. We can take our normal interferencing, but let's just actually, at some point, while it's in flight, while it's in this region, we pull away the screen, we take it away. So we don't allow it to hit the screen after all. So it just carries on going. Well, then what happens is it separates into two wave packets, and you can detect it always being here, are always being there without interference. And it's been suggested, well, actually, if you do this, then the measurement here tells you it actually went through that packet, and the measurement here tells you it went through that slit. In which case, the quantum doesn't even know whether it has to behave like a particle or a wave when it's going through the slits. You can delay the choice as to which experiment you do. What does all this mean? It can go even further, and in Marvel's experiment on this, a very interesting one was where a guy called Ashley said, okay, remove the screen, except at the points where the interference pattern is zero. So if it removes it at the points where the interference pattern is zero, the photon doesn't get absorbed. It can't get blocked. The intensity over here doesn't go down because it's never being blocked by the screen. But it's not being blocked by the screen because of the interference. At the same time, we're observing the particle behavior, which tells us which path it went. So according to Afshar, this completely destroys the wave particle duality argument. Here you have an experiment that shows wave and particle at the same time. There are other... Well, the particle behavior is argued that if it arrives over here, then it must have come from this slit. And if it arrives over here, it must have come from this slit. Because this wave packet evolves into a wave packet over here, and this wave packet evolves into a wave packet over here. That's, of course, if you believe this argument.
So these experiments have been done?
Yes. Quite a substantial number of these experiments have been done in one form or another. Certainly the optical cavity ones have been done, the delayed choice has been done. This experiment has been done. In fact, I know a guy at Imperial College who sets this as an undergraduate project. It's that easy to actually do these experiments nowadays. Right.
Sorry, I guess I don't understand the difference between when you have the screen kind of near and when you have the screen further away.
And between
that one
and
that one.
Right here, you
look. In the experiment, there's a lens that just focuses the two slits again to the screen.
Yeah.
to a further away screen.
So the results of the experiment are that you get either the top one or the bottom one?
Yes.
Or, right?
Yeah. You either have a click here or you have a click here. And these are quite separate. And they're exactly the spaces where you expect them to be if you just blocked off one slit or the other. So if you put the detectors here, the results you get are indistinguishable from if you were to block off one half or the other. There's a difference between saying this is compatible with it being a particle that follows one path and with saying this shows it actually followed one path. It doesn't show it followed one path at all. It's just compatible with it following one path.
Is there any significance to the sort of sideways lens?
There's two different regions. There's a region in which you get interference and then there's a much further region in which you get separation. And you have to do special things to make sure it. There are other different ways in which you can set this kind of interference. So this is just a particular representation. So there's lots of different kinds of interferometers you can use. I'm using the two-slit experiment as a way of actually showing them all. Yes?
Just to clarify, can I summarize the point in saying what you're doing by the two screens here is you're demonstrating it's possible to decide whether you are going to measure a property that implies that the particle went through one slit using a hidden variables ontology, or a property that implies that it could not have gone through one slit or the other, which is the closer screen, and you decide which measurement to make after it's already gone through the slits?
That would certainly be where, although I think the hidden variable part of it is not necessary. I mean, this actual suggestion was first presented by Wheeler. And he was not a hidden variable theorist. His argument, he was presenting this to argue his case that a phenomena is not a phenomena until it's an observed phenomena.
Right. So there's only a contradiction if you try to say that these properties that you're measuring must have been defined before you measured them. I'm going to shut up.
Well, arguably, that doesn't lead to a contradiction. The question is, how do you talk about those things? Some ways of talking about those properties are going to have difficulty with this kind of setup. Other ways aren't. Yes?
If we close the lower slit and we leave it very far, then wouldn't you expect to have Nagosian in the upper half instead of the lower half?
If you close that slit, then if you block that off before the photon has erupted, while it's in this region, then you only get detections here. Well, there's, I'll kind of skip through some more ones. There's some other interesting additions. For example, in this case, what you can do is, well, we have this information about which slit it went through. But rather than actually looking at that information, we can record the positions of the particles. And then later, we get together these two boxes and we put them together. And we wipe out the information by removing the gap between the two. So now you can't actually tell which box it was in. But you still can do a measurement on it that divides the wave packet in the quantum state in a different way, in which you can do effectively a Bell state measurement. And when you do that other measurement of it, you can take this pattern, which doesn't show interference, and it separates that pattern up into two sub-ensembles, depending on the outcome of the Bell state measurement, which individually show interference. When you add the two together, it disappears. And again, the nodes in both these interference patterns will be shifted by phase shifts that depend on both paths. So even long after you've actually recorded the location of the particle, allegedly, you can then still find interference in the ensembles. And some people say, well, actually what happens there is you've erased the information. So suddenly the interference has come by. Well, we now come to the question, well, what does this mean? If there was a matter of fact about which path it took, then you erase the information that ceases to be a matter of fact about which path it took in the past. It's another kind of these locutions about delayed choices. What does that mean? Yes.
Yes.
The quantum eraser experiments. Yes, this has been done. This experiment has been done as well. This one's really cool. You replace the single source with two completely separate sources. They have to be lasers and they have to be tuned to the same frequency. And you do them very high precision lasers, tuned to the same frequency, very low intensity, so at any one time, there's only one photon, and it's only coming from one of the lasers. And they still show interference. Now, to explain this one, you actually do have to look into quantum field theory.
But you mean on average?
On average, there will be one photon. You have this very low intensity, so the chance of actually having a photon emitted by both of them at the same time is very, very low. So you can't guarantee it.
Yeah, Alan.
Yes.
What if you turn one of the lasers off, let the thing run for a little while, and then you swapped over which one was turned off and which one was turned on and let it run for a little while, and alternated backwards and forwards? You know you could guarantee that
one would have to go and carefully look.
One laser.
One would have to go and carefully look. See.
I was worried about the problem of phase drift. If you set up lasers with a certain phase relationship between them, they tend to drift. How are you going to reconcile that with the fact your data gathering rate on that is going to be very low because of the low intensity of the lasers? And that tends to smear everything out?
All I'll say is the experiment's been done. And it's called the Flegel-Mendel experiment. I can provide references.
Right, I mean, not really the way you do a
but I would like to move on.
Have the same laser driving both of them and G.
They've done it with separate lasers, but there is an issue with phase drift.
Okay, we'll move on quickly. But one thing one can do, I mean, the interference effects are quite remarkable. One thing one can do is, say I have 1,000 bonds, or this is some kind of explosive material. The problem is the production method leaves a high chance of actually being good if it's not explosive. And for some reason, I'm working in construction where I really need to be sure that the construction dynamite that I'm using is not dud. I mean, it might be safety issues or something like that. And it's a very, very sensitive material, so if you hit it with a single photon, the genuinely explosive material explodes, but the duds don't. And what I need to do is I actually need to find out somehow which lumps of material are actually the working dynamite and which ones are the duds, without blowing up all my good dynamite. Well, the answer is, what do I do about that? I put it in a spirometer. If that's a dead piece of material, then the photon's just going to pass through and it doesn't get affected and you get interference. And that means there's a point here that the photon cannot go to. But if it's not dead, well, two things could happen. One is it could blow up. But if it doesn't blow up, and there's a 50% chance it doesn't, then the photon's gone through the other slit and there's no interference, and it can arrive at a point that would be forbidden. So if you use this, put it in the interferometer, well, and it arrives there, and your equipment hasn't blown up, you know you've got some active material there. And so if you had 1,000 of them, okay, half of them were dead and half of them blew up, a quarter of them blew up, but you've still got a quarter of them that you now know is perfectly good. And how can you have done that any other way? Quantum interferometry. Now when you go into entangled states, you can go further. Yes?
Well, not with bombs, but
not with bombs.
Did do that.
Interaction-free measurements and you, building on that and using the quantum Zeno effect as well to actually improve the efficiencies.
Yeah.
Yeah, those kind of experiments have been done, yes. This one's been done as well, just to get that out of the way straight away. So suppose we actually now have a source of entangled particles. We go up, up, and down, down. And we put phase shifters in these branches. So one particle goes in that way, and one particle is going that way. Well, complicated, we end up with this wave function, which has a global phase which we can ignore. We go, well, do we see interference here or here? Well, the first thing we note is what appears here is always a difference of the phases. So what we do with this phase setting certainly can't affect what appears here. Because if it did, we could use that to signal faster than light. We could make this very, very far away, mess around with the phase shifting here, see effects there, and go, aha! But we notice this is also a difference. For whatever shifting setting there, we could set a setting here that cancels it out. But if we can't tell anything over here from that setting, and we can't tell anything over here from that setting. So the interference vanishes. Okay. Does this mean we don't have to worry about interference for entangled states? No. Because if we now look at a correlation between where it arrives here and where this one arrives here, we find there is a correlation. And we have to bring together the results from both sides. That's why we can't signal with it. When we bring together the results from both sides, we find there's still a correlation, and the correlation depends, again, on the difference of the phase settings. So, we still have this thing. Superpositions still want a statistical mixture, even though it's an entangled superposition. And that's going to bring us on to the next great big problem of quantum theory. Exclamation mark. Prepare for arguments to break out. Suppose we prepare a system to be in a particular quantum state. And we want a measuring device that's intended to tell us it's in that state. It starts in some reference state. This is the measuring device. And to be a good measuring device, it interacts and ends up in some state U. And we want this U to be something like a big pointer here, and it's pointing to the letter U. This was the U state. And it's something big, and we can see it, and we all agree. We are seeing this big pointer pointing to the letter U. And yes, this experiment has been done. Because we're just I can fairly easily arrange it, I'm sure. We also wanted to interact with a different state D. So the measuring device, if we put an input for state D, the measuring device ends up pointing to the letter D. And we all agree, the measuring device is left pointing to the letter D. And we can build these things, and this is certainly what we know happens. Unitary evolution is linear. So if we plug in a superposition of U and D, what we get out is an entangled superposition. Should we be worried about this? What does this mean? Well, we are just trying to emphasize. An entangled superposition is not a mixture, still a superposition. Oh, just as another point, you can add an environment, doesn't help. Unitary evolution gives us this, which is not a statistical mixture. What we see when we feed in the U plus D superposition, however, is very clear. Half the time, the big pointer is pointing to the U, and half the time, the big pointer is pointing to the D. That is what we actually observe. And let's be clear about this. We see this. There is no ambiguity about this. The state of the world afterwards that we see, we either appear to see it as this, or we see it as this. This is not a statistical mixture. I repeat, this is not a statistical mixture. It is not half U and half V. What we see is a statistical mixture. So there is a mismatch between what? States being represented by rays in Hilbert space, and unitary evolution gives us, and what we actually observe.
This state, which you've written down with cats and stuff, it's a Hilbert space vector, is not a statistical mixture, and I agree with that.
Yes.
Then you said, what we see is a statistical mixture.
Okay,
so are you implying that the thing that we, that which we see, could be described by some sort of a Hilbert space operator? Is that the thing that we see?
What I mean by statistical mixture is not a, say, a necessarily density operator. I mean something much more clarified. What I mean by statistical mixture is, we did this experiment a bunch of times, and in about half of the times we actually see it pointing at U, and about half of the times we actually see it pointing at V. But in every single instance, we do actually see it pointing at U or at V. And that's what I mean by saying a statistical mix. In other words, what we actually see.
Owen?
Yes?
And then there is the... This is just my first problem making. What would be the alternative? Like you're saying that we don't see the actual superposition,
mm-hmm.
and for that to make sense, you'd have to say what the superposition would look like. Like what would the experiment be that could be called a superposition?
What would it mean to see a superposition?
Yeah,
that's a good question. What does it mean to see a superposition? However, in this case. I would say it's a good question and think that it's something that needs to be done. It doesn't help with the measurement problem because we don't see a superposition. What we see is that or that. So this is one particular state. It's like saying if the state of reality in a particular instance is that, because that's what we see, then this is not the description of what we actually see. There's something more that tells us in one instance we saw this, and the other instance we saw that. But what quantum theory gave us in both cases was the same state. So there's got to be something different about the first time we run the experiment and the second time we run the experiment. Because we saw different things. After the measurement outcomes happened, the state of the world looked different. But this doesn't give us anything different.
But Owen, I don't see
Ron,
that state.
I'm afraid this is probably a bit late for today, but I think we should let Owen give on a chance to get to talk before.
That's going to be... Okay, so, Jerry... So, well, there are a number of different points one can take on this. One is to actually say, look, no, we should take this seriously. Quantum theory tells us that quantum theories work so well. But that says both outcomes do occur. This is the actual state of the world. And this more or less requires you to believe in many worlds type ontology. And what actually is happening is our perception is splitting into two, and one perceives pointing at U and one perceives pointing at D. But the actual state of the world is both. Well, you might say the superposition is the actual state of the world. I believe in unitary evolution of states in Hilbert space. But I recognize that after the experiment, one or the other of these has actually occurred. So that means there's got to be something more to the reality after the experiment than this. Because there's got to be something more that says U or D. There's extra structure. If you follow that path, you more or less end up in a hidden variable in ontology. I say more or less. The hidden variables determine whether the U or V outcome has occurred. They don't have to determine in advance whether it will, but they certainly have to determine whether it has occurred after the experiment. Another option is you could say, well, look, clearly there's just something wrong with unitary evolution. The state of the world is U or D, and if unitary evolution doesn't give us that, then unitary evolution is empirically falsified. But if you want to make that clear, you better build a model of an objective collapse process to tell us when does the unitary evolution break down. And in principle, that will lead to different predictions to quantum theory, which is not necessarily a bad thing. And another option, you could say, well, look, the mistake made is to assume this is actually representing the state of the world at all. Maybe that isn't the case. Well, if you deny that, you could say, well, that's not actually reality, and nothing else is either. There is no microscopic reality. There are just observers, there are measuring apparatus. The measuring apparatus is pointing to U or is pointing to D, but we shouldn't think that that's the measuring apparatus, because that's just something we use to calculate. It's something that tells us something about what we know about what measuring apparatuses do. Or you could believe there is a microscopic reality, but in some sense it's inaccessible, and this state isn't telling us what's real, but it's telling us something about the most we know about that microscopic reality. And then that means that, yeah, the measuring apparatus is pointing to the U, or is pointing to the D, and it's the microscopic reality that's telling it. But I would point out, as far as I can see, that's hidden variables also. Okay, well, no talk on foundations would be complete or free of arguments if we didn't also talk about non-locality. So in 1935, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen noticed something. They didn't present it in exactly this form. So we start off with our entangled state, and now we have up, down, and down, up, and the particles goes. Suppose I'm on this side, and I have a look whether it's up or down. And then I phone my friend, and I find whenever I find it's up, he finds it down. Whenever I find it down, he finds it up. And this happens in every single case. Quantum theory is unambiguous. This happens in every single case. When I measure it to be up, I know that my friend will find it in the down channel. It's quite determinate. Well, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen look at this and say, there's only one thing you can think about this. Either, when I looked at it and I found it in the up channel, the reason why my friend found it in the down channel is because there was some fact of the matter about the world that made it already the case that it was going to be in the down channel. It was already determinately to be found in the down channel before I made the measurement. And if you don't believe that, there's only one other option. When I measured it on the left-hand side, I did something that made it determinate on the right-hand side. Because after I've measured it, it's determinate. If it was not determinate before, then my measuring it must have made it determinate. Well, the second possibility is non-local, and you can see that explicitly in wave function collapse theories. So EPR say, look, there's only one way to do it. You can either be non-local, or you can believe that it's already determinate, that there's extra structure, extra facts about the world. So the introduction of determinate, predetermined values, it was an attempt to avoid non-locality in quantum theory. The argument being that without those, quantum theory just is non-local already. Well, then, of course, Bell points out in a paper in 1963, any theory that reproduces the perfect anticorrelations of quantum theory. Sorry, was it 64?
It was the other paper in 63.
66? Ah, terrible. I got that wrong, it's 64. Any theory that reproduces the perfect anticorrelations of quantum theory and has locally predetermined outcomes, well, actually must satisfy an equality like this, which isn't actually the form we come across nowadays, because this was specifically about quantum theory. It used quantum theory in it. And Bell constructed this to go with the EPR argument to say that quantum theory is non-local, really, really non-local. It's non-local if you don't have determinate values. It's non-local if you do have determinate values. It's irreducibly, ineliminably, unequivocally non-local. Bell was quite clear on this one. However, lots of people didn't like this, and we've been arguing about what it means ever since. Helped by 1969, and I checked this one, so I'm sure that is right. In 1969, a more general inequality was derived, which didn't use quantum theory and its assumptions, whereas Bell's original derivation did. And this is also, however, violated by the single state in quantum theory, amongst others. And this has been derived since then under many different assumptions. So I'm not even going to try and go into saying what this is all about. It's been said that you need to assume locality and completeness. You need to assume locality and realism. It means you need to assume local causality. In the 1980s, there was an attempt to reformulate it in terms of what's called stochastic Einstein locality, or what might also be termed relativistic causality. What counts is, this one was Bell's own term, and it was the term he tended to stick to all along the way. And he, in 76, he did a derivation on the basis of local causality that didn't make reference to quantum theory or hidden variables or any of that kind of thing at all. All of these things lead to the CHSH inequality. So all of these things, in combination, every combination, is incompatible with quantum theory. So if you want to find loopholes, you've got to give up something in every single one of those derivations. More importantly, perhaps, we've done the experiments. Hurrah! Another lot of experiments been done. And that shows that nature is incompatible with these conjunction of assumptions. Because this derivation doesn't depend upon quantum theory. We've done experiments. We found this is violated. So we know that any theory that replaces quantum theory is also going to be, if it's compatible with nature, it's incompatible with these assumptions. Yes. Okay.
Well,
I'd say experiments have loopholes, and arguments have loopholes. And there are two kinds of loopholes that people present. One are what might be called logical loopholes, in which people try and find, in principle, arguments against the derivation, ways in which you can build real models, build actual physical models that violate this. And some of the kind of things we're involved in superdeterminism, retrocausality, the idea that influence can go back in time, exotic spacetimes. It may be entangled particles are connected by wormholes. And branching universes is one possible loophole as well. The challenge on these is to come up with actual worked out theories that exploit these loopholes. So it's very hard to see how that could happen in superdeterminism, because that says you can't actually have free choice of experimental settings. There's also empirical loopholes, and these actually more look at the actual saying, has the experiment really been good enough? What's actually going on? Now, empirical loopholes can be closed because you can improve the experiments. And there are quite a number of these, however. It's quite remarkable how many. When the aspect experiment was done, a lot of people went, that's it, nature's decided, we've got the answer. And in the intervening 24 years, it's actually turned out there's an awful lot of things that could else be going on. And an awful lot of experiments are having to be done to close those loopholes. And it would be fair to say there has not been a loophole-free experiment done. So these are the real problems that are confronted in terms of understanding quantum phenomena. So I'm going to briefly run through what we actually do. Well,
Okay,
so that inequality would be inconsistent with quantum mechanics.
That inequality is absolutely inconsistent with quantum mechanics. You can calculate the value of quantum mechanics at that 2 root 2.
It's inconsistent with the quantum mechanics. However,
yes.
In order to get that inequality, you have to assume a bunch of stuff which is incompatible with nature, so why bother with any of this?
Okay. It wasn't clear until anyone did the experiment that these assumptions were incompatible with nature.
Okay, and how does this go back on to, so is this non-local conclusion, is this right or wrong from the Bell head?
It's right, modulo, things that only people who really, really don't want to give up would still think about.
They're all...
It's right.
Yeah. I can look at that.
Don't you believe it's right?
I believe it's right, yeah. I think I noticed the common thread in all these is locality. So, well, I've got about a minute left. So what we actually do in quantum foundations is we worry about, to actually try and deal with these conceptual issues, what should we do? Do we interpret quantum theory? Do we reformulate it? Or maybe we need to replace it. And there are many different approaches. We have many worlds. Some of the problems that have been, and the advantages that are presented with many worlds, it's There's an issue in terms of Hilbert spaces not preferring any particular basis, but somehow in many worlds they do branch. But this is generally thought to have been solved by decoherence now. There's a more controversial question of the role of probability, in that if all outcomes determinately occur, our normal semantics of use of the word of probabilities doesn't seem to actually go through. And it's also claimed that the many worlds actually is local, and it has a loophole to the EPR argument. Well, this would make reconciliation between quantum theory and general relativity easier. There's collapse models, which attempt to build constructive, actual, objective physical models that tell you when the non-unitarity occurs. Generically, they don't conserve energy, even on average. There's a problem making them relativistically invariant. It's a common theme to all attempts to interpret quantum theory. But what's nice is they do make empirical predictions, so they can actually be tested. And it's hard because environmental decoherence has to be eliminated, and you have to be sure that's not taking place. But there's some suggestions in things like neutrino experiments. Some very imaginative suggestions are coming up that are pushing the boundary of what might be permissible for a collapse model. Hidden variables is another studied one. Some of the problems and advantages to this. It's long been suggested that it can't be extended to quantum field theory, although there's been some very good recent work done by people here on that. There's a certain ambiguity of what the hidden variable is. By nature, it's hidden, so how do you know? But there's questions about what actually could be a feasible hidden variable model, and various different workers are working on different kinds of things. It has a problem in that hidden variable models typically are no collapse models, so the Schrodinger evolution continues and the wave function is real. It's argued that those unobserved outcomes, the proportion of the wave function is there and real, exactly as in Everettian interpretations, so that really they're just as real, and this hidden variable isn't really doing anything, and you can interpret the hidden variable models as just Everettians with excess structure added to it. Though there are also suggestions that hidden variable theories usually only have particular probability distributions to reproduce quantum theory, and you might get deviations from that. So this would lead to novel experimental results as well. There's recent suggestions of psi epistemic theories. And this is to say, well, actually, maybe the wave function, this is part of the wave function isn't real, but there might be a microscopic reality. And can you actually construct effectively a hidden variable type model, although some psi epistemic people don't like that language of talking about it, in which these empty waves don't exist because they're actually just probability distributions that are epistemic rather than real. There's some suggestions that maybe we should be thinking about this in terms of information. Quantum mechanics has always seemed to present restrictions about what could be known. Perhaps it's not information about something, but rather information itself. The process of acquiring information is creating the information that is acquired. It's not finding out something. And then restriction about what may be known means that new information acquisition and validates the old. And this is what might be responsible for uncertainty relationships and so forth. Emergent classicality. If the world's so quantum and quantum is so weird, why do we behave so classically? And that's something that actually requires explanation, clearly. And decoherence is largely thought to be quite important in this. And there's also the construction of toy models. Two kinds. One could actually push this question, why the quantum and what is quantum? So one can try and construct local hidden variable models which do things that look really quantum. And the quantum theory requires entanglement to do so. Or one can construct things that quantum mechanics can't do. So there's actually further inequalities called Cyrilson inequalities that quantum mechanics doesn't violate, and we can construct models that are no signaling but do violate that. We could reformulate the mathematics, and I have to really hurry up now. There's axiomatic approaches which attempt to actually build on what's different to classical theories. So one might say, well, you can't clone signal or bit commitment, and that leads to quantum theory. You can generalize things like probability and logic, or you can define things in terms of operationalism. And often these generalizations offer glimpses of beyond quantum theory. So we actually have possibilities for theories that contain quantum theory in limiting cases, and maybe even suggest empirical tests of these. And finally, This does actually have relevance to other fields, so particularly to quantum information and to quantum gravity. Okay.
I yield. We have time for two quick questions. Greg, just a comment. You had about three lists where you apparently exhaustively showed all the options, but my personal answer to each one of them would have been none of the above.
Well, I answer that by paraphrasing the chair by saying, when it comes to interpreting quantum theory, the question is not which do you like the best, but which do you hate the least.
Another question?
Comment on cosmology? Can you make one?
Can I make a comment on cosmology?
Yeah, relevance.
It's very important. one of these, for example, there are suggestions that the non-unitarity and wave function collapse models might show some signature traces in the cosmic microwave background or early, that might be understandable better, that you might actually be able to look at cosmological data and in that find evidence for deviations from standard quantum theory. So,
I'm afraid at that point we have to wrap it up. I think you can see in this talk why it is that Owen's papers are so penetrating and so clear. Let's thank him again.